Welcome back to Ryan and Brian's Bible Bistro. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Brian.
And this is the Bible Bistro,
a podcast all about the Bible, theology, and all things related to the Christian faith.
Yes, absolutely. Whatever. Yeah. What? Gosh, you're really mixing it up here. Well, we're back. You know, we're back in the book that drives people wild. Everybody's crazy for
Revelation.
It. The Book of Revelation. So it's been good. We had a great setup last week.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, we saw the...
confidence he has in his own words. Yeah, well, I hope so.
We're talking about the seven seals, and of course the Lamb is the one who's worthy to open. No one else was found that was worthy to open the seven seals. He was worthy because he had, with his blood, purchased men for God. So
yes,
people for God. Sorry, I went back to the old NIV there for a moment.
Whoa.
Well, that's what it used.
The 1984.
That's what the 84 is. That's how it's translated. So sorry. Yeah. I used that one for a long time.
Well, we're back here. We're continuing on in Revelation. So we kind of looked at Revelation 5, and now we're in Revelation 6. And now we're talking about the four horsemen.
So the first four seals that are open relate to one another. And it's interesting. We see this with some other of the sevens. You know, we talked about these series of sevens. We're going to talk about the seven trumpets a little bit later, but then there's also seven bowls of wrath. And all of those three sevens, the first four all relate to one another. Okay. Four is an interesting number too, and we'll look at some of the Old Testament background here. But if you think about the points of a compass, for example, if you're thinking about north, south, east, and west, you know, we use kind of the cardinal directions as we say to talk about everywhere, and so that's probably where these fours at least originate. Back in Zechariah chapter 1, I didn't tell you to get Zechariah ready.
That's right. I read your mind earlier and already had it open. Okay. I did.
Go ahead and read the first the verses 8 through 15. This is Zechariah chapter 1. This is probably the direct background for what we have John writing here in these first four seals.
During the night, I had a vision, and there before me was a man mounted on a red horse. He was standing among the myrtle trees in a ravine. Behind him were red, brown, and white horses. I asked, "What are these, my lord?" The angel who was talking with me answered, "I will show you what they are." Then the man standing among the myrtle trees explained, "They are the ones the Lord has sent to go throughout the earth." And they reported to the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees, "We have gone throughout the earth and found the whole world at rest and in peace." Then the angel of the Lord said, "Lord Almighty, how long will you withhold mercy from Jerusalem and from the towns of Judah, which you have been angry with these 70 years?" So the Lord spoke kind and comforting words to the angel who talked with me. Then the angel who was speaking to me said, "Proclaim this word. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I am very jealous for Jerusalem and Zion, and I am very angry with the nations that feel secure. I was only a little angry, but they went too far with the punishment."
Right. So the idea is that God had used these pagan nations, right, these ungodly nations, in order to punish God's people because of their idolatry. Mm-hmm. You know, they had gone aside into other gods. They had done the things that God warned them not to do. So, you know, ironically, we've seen this all the way back, you know, throughout, especially when you get into the book of Judges, that God uses these peoples that God's people live in the midst of in order to bring correction to them. And so that's what's happened. But then the end of that 70 years is what Zechariah is writing about here. So now God is going to, so there's peace in the earth, right? But here's what I want here. The main thing I want you to notice, first of all, is that they went throughout the whole earth, right? Mm-hmm. So there's four different kinds of horses that are mentioned, and they go in four different directions. And the idea is they've examined the whole world, and they found that to be at peace. So God is saying now it's time for the judgment to come upon the nations that he used in order to accomplish the punishment for his people, and that's a very common theme in the prophets, if the Old Testament prophets, very common theme in apocalyptic literature. So Isaiah, for example, talks. Isaiah 10 is my favorite example of this. I hadn't planned on talking about this, but he talks about the fact that he's going to use Babylon in order to bring judgment to his people. But he says it when that king becomes haughty. when the emperor of Babylon becomes haughty, proud, and basically says it's because of my own power that I've accomplished this, rather than giving credit to God, he says he's a tool in my hand, and the same as I could use a club in order to accomplish my purpose, and then I throw it away, or I use a hoe and then I throw it away, and he says that's how the king is. And so that's the same kind of thing we're seeing here, that these pagan nations have executed judgment on God's people, but now God is going to be bringing judgment to them. Later in Zechariah, we find these horses again, and here it becomes even clearer what's going on. Go ahead and read that, and then I'll say some things about what's different.
And this is Zechariah 6:1-8. I looked up again, and there before me were four chariots coming out from between two mountains of bronze. The first chariot had red horses, the second black, the third white, and the fourth dappled, all of them powerful. I asked the angel who was speaking to me, "What are these, my lord?" The angel answered me, "These are four spirits of heaven going out from standing in the presence of the Lord of the whole world. The one with the black horses is going toward the north country, the one with the white horses towards the west, and the one with dappled horses toward the south. When the powerful horses went out, they were straining to go throughout the earth." And he said, "Go throughout the earth." So they went throughout the earth. Then he called to me, "Look, those going toward the north country have given my spirit rest in the land of the north."
Okay, so again, you see the idea of the four cardinal directions, the four different color horses. Now, here's the difference. One of the differences we're going to see between Zechariah and what John does in Revelation. I think John is, his vision is similar to Zechariah's. The difference is he sees four chariots pulled by these different color horses. Mm-hmm. What John is focused on, and this is why we call them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? These four, the riders is what John is focused on. So it's four different colored horses, singular horses, instead of like a team of, that's pulling a chariot as we have in Zechariah. But I'm just saying, in terms of the number four, I think this is the reason. He's saying this is kind of the judgment that's going out. It's related to Zechariah in that part of what John is answering with these first four seals, or I guess technically I would say what the Holy Spirit is saying through John in this vision, is he's showing, he's kind of answering this question, why are, as we've said before, why are God's people continuing to be oppressed? Why are we still going through these difficulties if the victory has already been won? And part of the answer is going to be that judgment is coming through these disasters, let's call them, or these acts, is what's going on. It's God's judgment upon those who would harm God's people. Now, the difficulty here, that's the context in Zechariah, the difficulty in the book of Revelation is this is going to affect God's people as well. God's people mm-hmm. are going to be affected by these same kind of things that are going to affect, let's just call it. I mean, who's oppressing? We talked about this last week. Who's oppressing God's people? Why is John in exile on the Isle of Patmos? It's Rome, right? Mm-hmm. It's the empire. And so what happens to the empire is also going to affect God's people in this. Mm-hmm. And so part of what then John is writing about is the way that we will then respond to these calamities that are going to come, these kinds, and I'll say, I don't think he's talking about any particular calamity. He's talking about these kinds of calamities that are going to happen. And the way that we, as God's people, respond is different because we have a different end, right? There's a different result for those who remain faithful. So it kind of even has a double effect. It can make us as God's people even more faithful when we respond, and it can, I don't want to say this, it can bring correction or judgment, depending upon our reaction, to those who are tempted to idolatry. And I'll go ahead and give this away too. This is not till later in the book of Revelation that this becomes clear, but one of the main things that John is warning about here is getting too cozy with the empire. Mm-hmm. Right. God's people need to place their trust in God, not in the emperor. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the battle here. Of course, the emperor in Rome even becomes, you know, and this is debated about exactly when, becomes an object of worship himself. But certainly he is looking for people to recognize that he is the giver. We've talked about before that he's given titles like the savior of the world, right? Mm-hmm. The one who is the bringer of peace. We have all this, even on the coins, we have this symbolism that shows that he's on the throne, right?
Right.
And so the book of Revelation, what we've already seen with God on the throne, with these things coming out from God, God is the one who's ultimately in control, not the emperor. That's the message. So for God's people, the warning is don't get too cozy with the government. I guess I keep saying cozy, but really don't throw your lot in with finding peace in that way.
Yeah, and we see, you know, that's part of Revelation 1 through 3 as well, as we right. see that in there, as we get yep. these, as the message is given to these churches. Like, some of you are facing persecution. Some of you yeah. have become way too comfortable yeah. in your context.
Exactly.
And that you've lost, you know, this is, you're lukewarm. I'm going to spit you out right. through some of this.
Right. And then later, you know, we've talked about this before in other parts of the book of Revelation. Later in the book of Revelation, it talks about, you know, the merchants and those who've taking comfort in Rome, and this image of, I think we even did an episode right on the harlot, the woman, mm-hmm. Babylon, right?
The whore of Babylon.
Yeah, the whore of Babylon. And so, so that's that idea of, you know, they've taken up their parts. Those who participated in her adulteries, is the way that it's said in chapter 13, are going to receive the due punishment that's coming. So anyway, let's get back to these seals. Let's talk about them. And also I will tell you, there's a note of hope here because again, in Christ, and this is the whole idea that in Christ, we have been given victory like we saw last week. And ironically though, look at verses 1 and 2, and there's a couple of questions we're going to have to answer with this. Go ahead and read that for me if you would, Ryan.
I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest.
So the first rider is on a white horse. And I will say, all four of these first four follow the same pattern. I meant to say this earlier. You have the seal is opened by the Lamb. Mm-hmm. Then you have one of the four living creatures. And you might remember that around the throne, we have these four living creatures in the throne room scene back in chapter 4. And then they are mentioned again in chapter 5. Each one of those four are going to give this command, come forth or come. They're saying, we're the ones who are calling for you. Notice it says it's a voice like thunder. You know, I often will say this is, there's a few things in the book of Revelation that are used to talk about the loudness of the sound. And I don't know if this helps or not. It helps me. So I hope it'll help you as well.
Okay.
Back, so we live in a noisy world.
All right.
Think about it.
Yes.
You know, I had the opportunity a few years ago, Josanna and I, my wife and I went to the Boundary Waters. And they had a canoe trip, and we were out there for a week. And of course, you heard sounds in nature, but there are no engines allowed out there. No motorboats. There's no planes going over. It is the quietest place that I've ever been for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. But we live in a place where there is and I've lived in very noisy places. Places where horns honk a lot more frequently than they do in this country.
Yes.
And where there's loudspeakers mounted on the top of trucks that are shouting political campaigns and that kind of thing. But we live in a time of amplified sound. Like you're probably listening to this right now with earbuds in, or, you know, you're through a speaker, whatever. We have that kind of noise. We have engines around us. We have airplanes. We have you know, the TV on, all these different sounds around us. In the ancient world, what you've got to think about is what would be the, if we didn't have explosions, if we didn't have combustion engines, if we didn't have jet airplanes and amplified sound, what would be the loudest things that we would ever hear? And so a few of those, John talks about the sound like the rushing of many waters, you know, like a waterfall, like Niagara Falls or Lake Cumberland Falls, something along those lines, something very loud where you have the water falling like that. He sometimes will talk about like a great crowd, like a whole bunch of people shouting, you know, that would be a loud sound. And then thunder. I mean, thunder would be a very loud noise in the ancient world when you'd have lightning and thunder. I mean, it's loud for us too, right? But it would have been, I think, shockingly loud in a context where there was much more silence. So anyway, this loud voice from this creature is the one who's calling each of these horsemen forth. So this shows the source. The source is God himself. God is the one who's calling these things forth. And that causes a little bit of trouble. In fact, we can see in the history of thought on the book of Revelation, even we can see this in some of the variant readings in a few later manuscripts. I mention this because if you use the New King James Version, there's going to be a little bit of a different translation here on even what's being said. But the best way to take this is a command from each of the four living creatures for one of the horsemen to come forth. And so God is the one who's directing this. What the New King James Version says, and it's following some later Greek manuscripts and the Textus Receptus, and we don't have to get into all of that, but what it says is that each of the four living creatures says, come and see. So basically they're saying, oh, it's the living creatures are asking John to come and to see what it is that's going to happen. And I think it's because of the difficulty. The reason this is in later Greek manuscripts is the difficulty of the idea that the God is the one who's directing these things that are going to happen, if that makes sense. Do you get what I'm saying with that?
Yeah, it was a hard thing to reconcile that, like, oh, these aren't just happenings because of sin in the world. No, God's making this happen.
Right. God's directing these kind of things. And so here's what we have then is this white horse, and it's interesting. We talked about the word, you might remember, winged victory. I hope you've looked it up.
Nikao. Nikao.
Nikao, yeah.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Nike. Yeah. We talked about Nike tennis shoes. I won't repeat all that. But this word victory, that's what that conquest is. And it's a doubled term here. Basically, there was a conquest or conquesting, you know, or a victoring. It's an Aramaicism again, a Semitic kind of doubling, like Holy of Holies, right? That emphasizes that this is a complete conquest. This is someone who's coming in and winning the victory completely.
So that's why you have like conqueror on a conquest. Like it's already decided. He is the conqueror and he's on a conquest.
Yeah. Now, here's where we get a little bit of difficulty. First of all, there's a bow that he has. Later in chapter 9, I believe it is, in the book of Revelation, there's a locust that have bows, right? They have women's hair and all this kind of stuff, probably referring to a group of people known as the Scythians who lived beyond the borders to the north and to the east of the Roman Empire. And they were feared. They were seen as the ones who were the threat, right? They were the bogeyman when you tried to you know, told kids nightmare stories.
Horror stories. Rome was like the dominant, but there were still thorns in their side out there. There were, you know, it's the Germanic people that they had to conquest for a while. Like, that was a problem for a long time. It wasn't just Rome. Yeah. Rome did conquer, but sometimes they were fought back. And so there's still people that were not controlled by Rome.
And they were known as horsemen. So I think this is probably the image we get. We certainly get it in chapter 9, and we can talk about that another day. But
because they did use bows as well.
They used bows, and in fact, they were known for their ability to use bows while riding a horse, which is not an easy thing to do. I know Ryan has tried.
I do it on a regular, so, you know, it's hard for me to relate about the difficulty in it.
You can imagine it takes two hands, right? Two arms to draw a bow, and so you're essentially guiding the horse with your legs. Mm-hmm. And so the Scythians had mastered this, and that was one of the things that made them a fearsome people. So The other thing we need to talk about, though, is later on in the book of Revelation, there is another white horse, a rider on a white horse, that is Christ, that is that is identified as Christ. And so there are some who want to see this in that same kind of way, that this is Jesus' conquest, or talking about maybe the victory of God's people, the church, you know, as it moves forward. I don't think, I think this is, again, drawing on the imagery we saw in Zechariah. I think these four, and again, if you look at the next two series of seven that have these four, they're related together. In other words, it's not there's one kind and then the other, but they're all four of the same kind. And so for that reason, I think this is a different rider on the white horse than the other one. I think this one is associated with these other four. Actually, I have it there in chapter 19. I forgot I put this notation down. If you look at Revelation 19, let me see if I can get there real quick.
I'm there.
Probably not. Oh, you're already there. Look at you. Go ahead and read that then, verses 11 through 16.
I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and wages war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but he himself. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God.
Okay, that's far enough. We can go. And there's other descriptions that are already used in chapter 1 of Revelation to describe this rider. Clearly referring to Jesus Christ is what we've got there. This writer, I think, is a different writer.
Yeah, we don't get as much imagery about him. We just say rider on a white horse.
Right, and so that's why. And of course, I will say some other things. Nikao, we've already seen this word victory is associated with Jesus. There's many crowns on his head there. There's one crown here, but I think we're thinking about a conqueror who's coming to cause oppression again, cause difficulty here.
And do we think maybe like the crown, like this is a king, like the Scythians would have had a king, like this is not just...
Yeah, this is the idea of rule, I would say. I don't think he's talking about crown. A specific king, right?
Yeah, but it is a crown would be another dominating force that's associated together.
Absolutely. So that's the first rider in this idea of conquest. Now, some people even think, and I don't know that it's necessary to think this way, that we have these four arranged in kind of a chronological way, not in a specific chronology, but basically saying when conquest comes, here is the result then, and the other things that we're going to talk about here. I don't know that that's necessarily it. I think we're thinking about, and we'll see this in the book, I'm going to bring up a passage out of the book of Ezekiel later on that I think is being drawn on here as well. But these are talking about the kind of things that happen sometimes to nations and to people is what we have going on. So the second one is rider on a red horse. Red is used throughout the book of Revelation, talk about danger. And so this one, go ahead and read verses 3-4 then back in Revelation 6.
When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make people kill each other. To him was given a large sword.
So this is sometimes called bloodshed or, killing, however you want to think about this. We could say warfare, but we have conquest. The idea of being ruled over by a foreign nation, and then this idea of people, taking one another's lives, that kind of an idea, danger, we could say. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think this is Kester maybe brought this up, is Craig Kester. We talked about his book, but I think he talked about like the white horse was an external force fighting against Rome. Yeah. But this was kind of like an internal violence that like the society that you thought was stable internally is going to turn on itself as well. And like that, what we see here is that this is violence. I mean, this is the kind of that bloodshed, the thing that you think like, oh, we all live together in harmony in some ways in Rome, but like no, there's gonna be destabilization internally as well.
Division and fighting amongst oneself. The thing particularly there to notice in relation to what you said there in regard to Rome is it says that he is going to take away peace, right? This is where was that?
That was in verse 4. Yeah,
the rider was given power to take peace from the earth. Mm-hmm. And so Rome, one of the things that they took a great deal of pride in was this idea that they had brought peace, right? They saw themselves as the ones who were enforcing this peace. Of course, the phrase Pax Romana is on the coins. It's one of their slogans that they like to point to. But here is the idea that they're not the ones who bring peace, right? And the peace mm-hmm. can be taken away. And so, I think that's a good way to understand or to see this. Then we get the next one. This is the rider on the black horse, then. This is Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 through 6.
Yeah. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wage, and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wage, and do not damage the oil and the wine.
So the idea of the scales are related to economy, obviously. Particularly here, we have food that's mentioned. Mm-hmm. So this writer we often call famine. It's the idea that food is going to become very expensive. It's something, again, that happens in the aftermath of war. It's something that happens in the aftermath of conquest. But the idea is that it's going to become very expensive. So just to give you an idea here, and the NIV has translated this, technically the word is denarius here, which is about a day's wage. That's what, you know, we've seen that other places. In Jesus' parables, he talks about denarii, you know, or... That's the unit of measurement we find in the Gospels, for example. But a denarius was about a day's wage. So remember the parable of the workers in the field, where mm-hmm. the ones that were hired in the morning were given a denarius. Those who came out at noon, and they were like, "Oh, that's not fair. They've not worked all day, right?" So
right.
So that kind of image of a day's wage. Now, a quart of flour, basically, is what we're talking about. I can't remember what the NIV said there. I guess I should have
it open for me. 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wage.
2 pounds. Yeah. So according to this is exactly in the historian Herodotus, the same measurement that's used here is said to be the amount of food that you need for your day. So literally, when we talk about daily bread, 2 pounds of flour would be enough for your food for one person for a day. Now, the problem is if you have a family, right, mm-hmm. then that's not enough. And so the barley, the idea is a less desirable grain. You could have enough of it to feed your family for a day's wage is the idea if you didn't have a very large family. So that's kind of what's going on. And just to give you I think it was I'm trying to remember the number he said, but it was 10 to 20 times more, like the price that's mentioned here is 10 to 20 times the normal amount for wheat, right? It's a very expensive, it's talking about the economy has become such so that famine is going to be a reality. So if you think about just that amount, like a day's wage is just enough to buy enough wheat to keep us alive, or enough flour to keep us alive, then there's nothing for the oil or the wine, right? There's nothing to use to make it into bread or to drink along with your bread, right? There's all there is enough to fill your belly, nothing for anything else. You know, you think about your entire. Imagine if you were in a situation that your entire salary had to go for your food for that day. So we're talking about, you know, not having enough money for anything else.
It's a literal hand to mouth. Like, yeah, that's it.
Absolutely.
And the only place literally. It goes your mouth. It's yeah. not like, oh, I'm paying for this or something else. It's literally right. hand to your mouth.
Right. And so that's the image we have here of this idea of famine, that's taking place. Oh, and I was going to mention that several times the normal price is in the commentary by Greg Beale, which is a fantastic commentary. I'll warn you, it's very technical. I don't know do we have that on our website?
I think we might have the shorter one.
Okay.
And that's a good one. Now, mind you, the shorter one is still like 600 pages. So
yeah, the big commentary that Beale has
is like 1200.
It's very, very good, but it is very technical. You know, it uses a lot in the languages and that kind of thing. So any other questions on what we...
If we start with the first one, we've got the bow, we've got the rider on the white horse. Right. It's kind of an outside influence of power mm-hmm. problem. Like, so this is this is what God's doing, is sending an outside force potentially. And then we have the violence to take away the peace. We talked about Pax Romana. And now we have this idea of famine or out, the economy crashing in some way here that does not support really life or much life at all.
Not being able to provide for the people. Not being able to provide what their needs are.
And this would have been... So, you know, we think about Rome, and it's hard for us to wrap our minds around, I think. I keep listening to more historians, you know, kind of talking about Rome, because I'm a guy, and guys think about Rome 100 times a day, apparently. I don't know. But
I'm about 100 times a day. I mean, I do think about Rome pretty regularly, but I feel like it's kind of my job, you
know? Yeah, well, I don't know how that meme started, but where men think about Rome all day.
Well, I guess it was a study, right? Anyway, we're getting a little off.
Yeah,
we can get an interview with the author of that study.
But if for them in this context, some of these things, yeah, they might be annoyance, but like to go to this level would have seemed an impossibility almost. Like this is a place where the Rome, as you had mentioned, took. You know, they maintained things pretty well.
Yes.
Like they kept a tight rein on people. You know, they moved the armies where they needed to move the armies to maintain borders and so forth. And even economically,
the roads.
For them, for this relative
peace, there wasn't piracy on the Mediterranean like there had been in previous ages. Yeah, so, I mean, it was a time of travel. Yeah,
yeah, and we've talked about this a little bit before, like. You know, there was one question at one point about like, well, could John have really written this letter because the Romans wouldn't have never let it go out? But in some ways, what we're kind of describing here of like these things happening seem almost an impossibility to happen to them.
It's talking about what you, again, the warning here is don't put your faith in the governments of this world. What might seem to us to bring stability will become unstable. There will be instability. And if you put your faith in the wrong foundation, then it is going to fall, essentially. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're not done with this, but you know, that
you want to make some application? Is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm going to say even in our world today, things that I remember from history.
Like an old man. So.
Well, I'm going to be 43 in days, so I'm basically, you know.
That's right. You have a birthday coming up.
Birthday coming up. I'm going to say this, and everybody thought it wasn't perfect by any means, imagination, but you have the USSR. Yeah. You have a nation that rises and falls.
Yep.
You know, you have a people that rise and fall. We've seen countries change names and leaders come and go, and places that seem to have some stability imploding. Now, for application, do we ever feel like, you know, we're, I think in the United States, there's a sense of, this couldn't happen to us. We couldn't fall down this trap. We couldn't ever. We're so stable. Now, I think there might be more people today that believe that than have believed that in a long time. We do have some weaknesses that could be exploited against us. And so I think this is a really important lesson for us as we think through this, to kind of go, you know, John's being shown this vision of the things that we tend to put our trust and peace in that are always going to be stable and that we've kind of built our lives around may not always be there.
And we are going to do this at the conclusion as well. But let me go ahead, since you just said that, let me go ahead and say, you know, here's the difference in the way that I read the book of Revelation and the way that I think it was intended to be read. He is talking about some very specific things that are going to take place, I think, in Rome. But it's also this idea, you know, here's the long-term application for us is not, hey, when are these specific four things going to happen? Because, I mean, we could look in the last, you know, several years probably, if we could line these up. And that's why people are, you know, wondering about these seals. And they're saying, oh, where are we in the midst of it?
What's the sequence? Where are we at the sequence?
That's not the point. The point is that whenever these kinds of things happen, whether it was the Great Fire of London, or you know, whether it's you know, World War One or World War Three or, you know, whatever.
Whatever.
The conflicts that we see immediately around us, whenever those kind of things happen, this is a lesson for Christians on how we are to respond. And I'm going to use the words of Jesus a little bit later on. I haven't mentioned, I say a lot about the Old Testament background of Revelation. We've talked about that some, that it's, you know, I say, there are some, we're going to see an almost direct reference a little bit later. There's very few quotations of the Old Testament in the book of Revelation, if any. Some people would argue there's no complete quotations, but there are many, many allusions, right? Like we see with the Zechariah stuff. And so I talk a lot about that. But the other thing I always say is Revelation doesn't teach us anything differently than what Jesus taught us in the Olivet Discourse, than what Paul teaches us in the book of 1 and 2 Thessalonians, than what Peter teaches us in the books of 1 and 2 Peter. In other words, these things are consistent. The Revelation, you know, we treat it like some kind of weird addendum.
Mystical.
Right. Yeah. It's different than anything else. But it has the form of apocalyptic. Read Zechariah sometime, right? Mm-hmm. Read Ezekiel if you want some.
Yeah.
But it's not that it's this weird thing. It's a way of telling. It's a way of speaking about God's truth, and in particularly about how we live within these kind of context, in an imaginative and I think a very, I don't want to say this, a very poignant way, a way that gets our attention, right? That's what Revelation is about. And so it's not going to be different than what we see in these other books. It's not teaching us some kind of strange esoteric knowledge that we have to have, you know, some kind of secret key in order to unlock. Here's the disappointing thing. What I can sum up in one sentence what Revelation is telling us. It is telling us that we need to remain faithful no matter what comes our way. No matter what happens, remain faithful. That's the message of the book of Revelation. Whether you're in exile on the Isle of Patmos because of Rome, or you're in a concentration camp during World War II, or mm-hmm. you're the aliens coming. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up about the future, but
we've got a little glimpse behind the gray matter there on Brian.
Yeah, now that'll be a great title for this episode. When what the Book of Revelation says about aliens. No, it whatever happens to us, what we're called to do is to remain faithful, right? And we're going to see this, and then we'll talk a little bit more about this in just a moment. Let's look at this last horseman before. Yeah. Let's open this fourth seal before we get too much farther.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, here we go. Verse 7. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth.
Okay. So here we have Death and Hades. And the horse here, the color, you said pale horse is what it sometimes said. You might remember Zechariah, it was a dappled horse, pale or sometimes pale green, people will say. It probably, so the white one is victory, right? It's this idea of conquest. The red one is bloodshed. Well, that makes a lot of sense. The black one, famine. It fits this idea of, you know, even death by famine, perhaps. But here we have death. And this idea, I would say a sickly horse, right? Yeah. A pale, pale green. This word, and we're going to see it when I look at this in Ezekiel in just a minute, this word that is death, it's the Greek word thanatos, where we get, you know, we get words that are related to that in English. This idea of death is used in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, is used to translate words like plague, or disease, or pestilence. So it's death, but I think particularly what's being focused on with this pale horse, this pale green horse, is the idea of death by plague, by disease, we could say. And of course, Hades follows close behind death. These two, you know, they always seem to go together. just like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
Like kinda, jelly, you know, to the donut.
They're in step together. But I don't know where I came up with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. But in the book of Psalms, for example, you know, where you have Hebrew poetry, death and the grave, that's the way we sometimes will translate Hades. You got to remember, and this is the hard thing for us to get our head around as well, but you got to remember Hades was a Greek god. It was, mm-hmm. it was one of their gods. He was seen as the master over the abode of the dead. And so this idea, I guess if you, there's a video game Hades, and anyway, you might know more about it then, but
move on.
The idea of the grave, we sometimes use Hades just for the grave, this idea of where you go, is not necessarily even always negative. It's just saying where the dead people are. Mm-hmm. And so death and Hades work together closely. We sometimes use Hades or Hades to refer to hell, but that's, the book of Revelation says this is where death and the grave are put. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily talking about that. It's just talking about the grave is the way that I would understand this. Look at Revelation 1:18, just one example, where it says Christ has become, there's that word nikao again, has become victorious over death and the grave. Do you have it? Did you get it there?
Yeah, 1:18 here. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I'm alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades.
Okay, so there's the idea that he has the keys, right? He has the victory over death and the grave because of his resurrection. So, you know, that's what we see here. This, some people say that this one kind of summarizes the others. It's death in general, but again, I think the particular thing is
pestilence, disease, like a disease right. mindset again.
So Ezekiel 14, this is the reason I think this. The four things that we see here are, you know, it's not the first time in Scripture we see these. I'll start in verse 19 or so. It says, "Where if I send a plague into that land, God says, and pour out my wrath on it through bloodshed, killing its people and all their animals, as surely as I live, declares Sovereign Lord, even if Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it." These righteous three, right? Mm-hmm. They could save neither son nor daughter. They would save only themselves by their righteousness. For this is what Sovereign Lord says, how much worse will it be when I send against Jerusalem my four dreadful judgments, sword and famine and wild beasts and plague, to kill its men and their animals. So there's that idea of plague, and in the Septuagint, it's Thanatos. So these four, sword and famine and wild beast and plague, is what we have, you know, kind of summarizing these four judgments here. Now, notice, I want you to notice one more thing. This is a little thing we see in the book of Revelation from time to time. It's an example of, we think of the, or I think anyway, of the figure of speech that's called synecdoche, which is where we can
say that again.
Synecdoche, not schenectady. I don't know what's the place in New York.
Schenectady.
Yeah, not that.
I don't know.
Synecdoche. Synecdoche. Okay. It's the way we refer to the whole by means of a part, or we use the part for the whole. So, I'm trying to think of an example. One that we might use. You see this example all the time is if I say I have a hired hand. Well, it's not just a hand. I'm referring to the whole person.
Not cousin it.
Exactly. It's not cousin. No,
is it it? Is that the hand? Is that no? That's not no, cousin no, it. That's it's the
no,
hair.
Thing. I don't know.
Thing. Whatever. Cousin it's the hair.
Yeah.
Adam's
yeah.
Family.
Thing. Yeah.
Cousin.
I don't know. It's been a while. I need to watch.
Brush. I need to brush up on my Adams family lore.
Anyway, so that's an example of using the part to refer to the whole. And we see these fractions, a fourth part, right, used here, but there are four things. And that's usually, there's one exception, that's usually the way it is in the book of Revelation. So it'll say a third of this, a third of that, and a third of the other thing, right? Or here it says a fourth, they will kill a fourth. What does it say there? I've forgotten. I was in Ezekiel.
Yeah, when the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice. They are given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword.
to kill by sword, but then it goes on.
By sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth.
So see, four things. So there's a fourth each for those four mm-hmm. things. So it's talking really about the whole, the destruction of the whole earth mm-hmm. Is what's really being referred to, or killing all of the people. The fourth, the fourth, fourth, and fourth is the way it's referring to this. So again,
and it's a little bit of like kind of hyperbole as well here. Like not everyone's going to be dead.
Okay. Right, right. It's just, it's going to be a very severe thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be like the end of the world, let's say, something to that effect. Yeah, very severe judgment that will be brought. And so again, what's the lesson for us? The lesson is that we don't place our trust. And I want to say this. One of my favorite passages that teaches this is in the book of Psalms. I can't remember what chapter it is. I wonder if it's 45th Psalm. I can't remember right now. But some place their trust in horses, right? Mm-hmm. I place my trust in the Lord God, right? We don't place our trust in chariots. We don't place our trust in Egypt, right? When I'm saying Egypt there, because that's where sometimes the kings go to run, the Judean kings go to run with help against the Babylonians, right? We don't trust in these other things. Instead, we place our trust in God. And that's really the message. We are faithful. When I use the term faithful, what I mean is that we are placing our trust in God to be the one who delivers us. And so even when we are in situations where there is conquest, where we see one country defeating another, even if it's our country, right? Mm-hmm. Where we see this internal strife and the death and the bloodshed that's done within, when we see death by famine, when we see economic collapse, when we see disease and death in that way, what we do is we continue to remain faithful despite all those things. That's the message. So I wanted to wrap up just with, we had John Wesley talk about the Olivet Discourse in Luke. What was that, last year, right?
Yes.
Matthew's version, I just wanted to look at it, and kind of here's where he summarizes this. This is Matthew chapter 24, the Olivet Discourse. We call it that because he's on the Mount of Olives, right? And this is, you might remember, this begins when his disciples are looking at the temple saying, oh, look at this magnificent structure. And Jesus says, you think that's great? There's a time coming when not one stone will be left on another. I think he's referring there to AD 70. They're basically like, that's got to be the end of the world. What are the signs mm-hmm. that we're looking for that this is going to happen? And so Jesus talks partly about this conflict that's going to come when the Romans come and destroy Jerusalem, right? That's the first thing that he refers to. But starting in verse 4, he says this. He says, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many, saying, you will hear of wars, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come." So wars and rumors of wars, right? And we get all flustered, right? Right. Jesus' response is, don't be alarmed. Don't allow these things to cause you alarm. We have a different perspective because we are followers of the sovereign Lord, the sovereign one, the one who's really in control. That's what apocalyptic literature is telling us. Things are not what they seem, but there's something else happening behind the scenes. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. That's the way it has been from the beginning, right? Rome rose and Rome fell. Right, there are other nations that have risen, as you mentioned, and even in our lifetimes, we've seen nations divide. Mm-hmm. We're seeing right now nations that are going through difficulty. You talked about internal conflict. I mean, look at the country of Haiti right now, what would it be? Here's the thing you need to think about. If you were, and see, we read the book of Revelation from such a weird position too, right? But if you were in Haiti, reading the book of Revelation right now, right? What would the message be? The message would be, these things will come. That's one of the ways God's justice and judgment is done. You continue to trust in him. right? That's the message. So, you know, all these things, kingdom against kingdom, there'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. The thing about birth pains is you don't know when they're going to, you don't know when the birth is going to happen exactly, right? I mean, you have some idea, obviously, but birth pains are painful. They result, however, in new life. The result is a positive thing. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted, he says to his disciples, you know, and this is something that's happened throughout history as well. Christians have been persecuted. You'll be handed over to be persecuted, put to death. You'll be hated by all nations because of me, Jesus says. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. That's the message. The one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So the idea is that these kind of things will happen again and again and again. The gospel is going to continue to grow. The gospel is going to continue to be preached. What we are called to do, if we're followers of Jesus, is to remain firm and remain faithful and not be shaken or alarmed by the news around us. You know, I get it. It's troubling. It's troubling to look around us, but when we as Christians sit around and just talk about how bad things are, we're really missing the primary task that has been given to us. What if instead of like, oh my goodness, look how bad things are in, I'm not even going to name a country, right? How bad things are there. You know, how bad the economy is here, you know, maybe those kind of things. What if instead our testimony, what it meant to maintain our testimony, is to say, I know, you know, the good thing is no matter how bad things get, no matter how many wars or rumors of war, all that, I know that I have trusted in the one who has kept my life. And even if I should die, then I am still, you know, eternally with him. That's I think the testimony that we're called to maintain. But that's what John's doing. I'm on the Isle of Patmos, right? I am being persecuted because of my testimony and because of the word of God. And yet my message is going to be, no matter what comes, we need to remain steadfast and faithful in the midst of it. That's what I think is the primary point.
Mm. Yeah. And it's, you know, that, I don't know, we were thinking, reading about like the pestilence and disease. Yeah. Well, we know that pretty well recently, right. But you know, there's this, we get caught up in health and you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's like all these things that can happen quickly, and that no matter what happens in that. And as you pointed out here, you know, there's persecution that comes through that stuff, and there's no, in Revelation, we don't see like, and all those who are righteous are plucked from, exactly, from this context.
Exactly.
That they don't experience the famine. They don't, no, actually that's not in there. And I know we've talked about this many times before, and I've read a book about this, but like how the church grew. Yep. During Roman time was blood of martyrs that you know, that that maintained faithful testimony to the point of death.
Yep.
And it stood as a testimony to pagans or Gentiles of the time that this was not a fleeting belief, like that was holding firm to their faith in Christ.
And I'll just say one more thing, the idea there that in the midst of this, we are called to continue to show the love of God to those around us. That's part of our testimony. Mm-hmm. And you know, I hear a lot of Christians saying a lot of things about, you know, the cause of, you know, what all this is. And, you know, we've suddenly become so smart, we figured it all out, right? But again, I don't think that's primarily why God has put us in the situation, the time that he has given us, He's called us to be his faithful witnesses, I think is the point.
I was listening to a podcast this morning.
You listen to podcasts?
I do. Podcasts are the best. You should support all of them that you hear, especially this one. I was listening to a podcast this morning, and it was talking about Christians and the plague.
Yeah.
And, right. you know, it's talking about, like, it was kind of this development of Christian society in that, you know, Christians, you know, that Rome had, again, yes. I was thinking about Rome again earlier today as a man, that they had, you know, like, if you had a slave or you had a soldier, you nursed them back to health because they had use to you.
Yeah. It was utilitarian.
Utilitarian. You know, like, I'm going to get my money's worth out of this person. But, like, as Christians, like, developing the hospital, but that during the plague, Christians were really the ones that were putting themselves in place to care for those.
They weren't afraid.
They weren't afraid of
what could happen to them. And they wanted to care for other people. Yeah, the beginning of hospitals, you know,
And in those days, like, especially with the plague, like, you were risking yourself. It wasn't just like, oh, I'm caring for you. I'm risking myself. And this author was talking about, like, you know, a lot of people with the plague, once they got sustenance, like, someone was caring for them, water, you know, some of them still died, obviously, but got better.
Yeah.
And, you know, the common thing at that point was, you're sick, get them away from me. No one cared for them. And then obviously they passed. And so,
not dead yet.
Bring out your dad.
He's mostly dead.
Yes. But that, wow.
A little Monty Python there.
A little Monty Python for the four horsemen. But the, you know, the call is to live faithful in that context. And what does that look like? And that's something that's, I thought about myself. Could I go do that? Am I willing to do that? And what that says about me. So, you know, that's a question for all of us. But, you know, to remain faithful and to maintain witness, it's not just to go, oh, I worship you, God, and to hide in a cave. But it's like, how do I, whatever that context looks like, how do I maintain faithful witness? Witnessing is I'm displaying it, not just hiding from the bad stuff out there.
I think that's right.
So, well, Brian, thanks so much. What are we going to look at next time?
We're going to look at the slain saints under the altar.
That's a classic.
Well, and just going along with what you said, I mean, this is the natural progression, right? Those who died because of their testimony, because of maintaining it. That's who they're talking about, and they're crying out for vengeance. So,
well, that should be fun. Maybe we can work in some Monty Python there.
Probably.
We'll find a way.
Relates to most things.
Yeah. All right, Brian. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And look forward to chatting with you next Tuesday.
Oh, see you next Tuesday.
And I'll have the books, you know, if you're still interested in those Revelation books, they are on the website.
Yeah.
You can go to each episode, and there's a little button for links. And then I'm going to have a featured book on the homepage, or you can just click on book resources, and you can just
dig in. If you found this useful, share it.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brian.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.